The topic tonight is announced as the Amish. And it might have been more honest to say that it's the Mennonites and the Amish. This is really a cluster of groups, a set of groups, whose earliest origins are in the mid-1500s and the later 1600s. Oh, please, stop. Please roll the tape. This is Deanne Lagerquist. This is the third in a session, Elder Hostel series on Christianity and community. Tonight's session is on the Mennonites and the Amish. This is a set of groups whose origins are in the mid-1500s and late 1600s, but who trace their existence to the New Testament. Many Christian groups, if you read a history of their denomination or of their group, start with the New Testament, right? And then it goes along. Like if you're a sort of caricature of Lutheran historiography would be, there was Jesus and there was Paul, and things started to go downhill. And then they got really bad, and then there was Luther, and it started to look up. Right? Okay. Now, that would be more likely to have been written in the 19th century by a Lutheran historian than in the 20th century. Okay, I am myself currently writing a history of American Lutheranism, and I don't start with Jesus and Paul, and I don't say that everything between Paul and Luther was a wasteland. And I wouldn't want to say that Mennonites and Amish make quite that stark of a picture, but they do. Their tracing of their origin to the New Testament has a much more is based on deeper convictions than the 19th century predisposition of all Christian groups to trace themselves to the New Testament was, and that has to do with their understanding of their goal. They're part of the Reformation, but their goal, rather than to reform, was to restore. Okay, remember I talked about the New Testament era as a golden era? And first I said, oh, it wasn't a golden era, it was really awful, and people didn't know what they were doing, and they did 12 different things at once, and they got in fights and arguments all the time, but some people think of it as a golden era. And this is not to suggest that the Amish or the Mennonites are naive, but it is to suggest that they looked more directly to the New Testament for their models than the other reforming groups did. And I'll say more about that in a minute. One of the predecessors of the Mennonites and the Amish is a man named Hans Denk, who is reported to have coined this aphorism: no one may truly know Christ except he follow Christ in life. No one may truly know Christ except he follow him, Christ, in life. This is an important kind of slogan for this whole group that's really committed to the idea that the knowledge of God, of who God is, right, leads to a godly life. That those two are linked so much that if you don't have a godly life, you don't know God. It must show in what you do. Okay, now I've organized my remarks tonight three historical beginnings, and then a look at Amish life in the United States. Those are pre-digested notes. Okay. So three beginnings. One will be the Anabaptist stream of the Reformation. One will be the Amish in Europe, and then the third will be the Amish movement to the United States. Now, I did want to say at this point something about Anabaptists, who I'm going to describe. If you're ever near Goshen, Indiana, and I'm blanking on the particular name, it may be a Napanee or Shipshawana. This is where my in-laws live near there. There's a wonderful museum of Anabaptist history. And when we go to, as I suppose happens to everyone, when you go to your in-laws, whoever it is, you're always looking for something to do. So we'd already been to see Billy Sunday's Tabernacle in that direction, and I read in a guidebook that there was this Anabaptist museum, and it's a wonderful, wonderful facility. And it's also, as the Amish and Mennonites are known for, it's good eating around there. Going through this Anabaptist museum was a very interesting sensation for me as a church historian, but a church historian who has some confessional identity, because they told the story of, you know, kind of like I did. Well, there was Jesus, and then there was Paul, and things started going downhill, and then there was the Reformation, and Luther had the right idea, but he really didn't finish the job. You know, and I'm like, no, Luther was great. What do you mean Luther didn't finish the job? Okay, there's this other part of the Reformation. The typology of the Reformation can go into three or four parts. And the part that probably most of us in this room, since I know something about your religious affiliations, are most familiar with, we would call the magisterial, or the moderate group. Some people would even go so far as to call it the conservative, but I think that's a little too much. Then you could also extrapolate, probably you would be able to figure out, that there's a Roman Catholic reform movement, that Roman Catholicism before the 1500s is not the same as Roman Catholicism in the 1600s, that something happens in that century. And then we're never quite sure what to do with the English Reformation. So I'm going to put that in there in parentheses. Some people try to divide the English Reformation up between these other parts, but things take place on a slightly different pace in England, and so sometimes we separate it out as a fourth category. Then there's this other one, which has some similarity to that drawer in the kitchen where you look for a rubber band. Okay. Most often, this is called the Radical Reformation. And the standard history of the Radical Reformation by George Williams is about this thick, and it's yellow. And it almost drove me crazy because I was trying to keep it straight. I mean, it's lots and lots of groups. I think the most helpful analogy for most late 20th century Americans for understanding the Reformation era is to think of the 1960s in Southern California. Lots of wild things were going on. People were trying all kinds of things. Now, my reference to the drawer where you try and find rubber bands suggests that there's nothing that these things have in common, the radical reformers have in common, except that they don't fit there. And that's not fair. They do have some things in common. And they have things in common that fall into three clusters. Okay, so within this typology, then we have three subgroups. I'm coming to the Anabaptists. Just wait one second. Okay, one group we call the rationalists. And there weren't a lot of them. And of all the groups, they're the group that is most... is least likely to form ongoing communities. But an example of that is that one stream of Unitarianism comes out of the rationalist part of the Radical Reformation, the Transylvanian Unitarians. Then there's another group called the Spiritualists. And the Shakers, who we'll talk about next time, are related to the spiritualist strand, although a couple of generations removed. Probably the group that comes from the spiritualists that we're most familiar with nowadays is the Society of Friends, or the Quakers. Okay. Then the third group, which is really the largest group, and in some ways the most cohesive subcategory of the Radical Reformation, are called Anabaptists. Okay, I shouldn't have put the one I was going to talk about way at the bottom. Can you see it? Now, notice it is not anti-Baptist. with my Midwestern vowels, you might have missed that. It's Anabaptist, and what this means is three baptizers. They didn't call themselves that, but it is distinctive of one of their principles. This is the principle that baptism is something for believers, not for infants. Baptism is for believers. Consequently, at least in the first generation, these people who had been Roman Catholic and become Anabaptists are re-baptized in order to have believers' baptism. And that's how they get that name, to be called Anabaptists. Let me tell you some other distinctive features of the Anabaptists. By about 1540, this has begun to coalesce so that we could say, here are some things that are distinctive of them. Of course, believers' baptism, which first takes place in the 1520s in Zurich. Do you want me to say anything more about those other kinds of reformers? Maybe I could just say, the magisterial reformers, that's like Luther and Calvin and Zwingli. Okay? And one of these points here I'll make, this very next point I'm going to make, will allow me to contrast these with the magisterial. The Anabaptists rejected alliance between Christianity, between the church, and civil authorities. Since the time of Constantine, which I characterized rather loosely as Christianity becoming the inside religion, there'd been this alliance between the political authorities and the churchly authorities. Not always an easy alliance, but nonetheless an alliance. And the Anabaptists reject that. And that's in contrast to the moderates or the magisterial. What that word refers to is that Luther and Calvin, each in their own way, continues to have an alliance with the civic authorities. Okay? And so the magistrates, and that's why it's called the magisterial reform. The Anabaptists, related to this, also had a principle of non-resistance. These are the historic peace churches, right? The Mennonites, the Brethren, the Amish, and so forth. Non-resistance. They looked for the restoration of the early church. They, unlike the early church, which didn't have a blueprint, thought that the early church gave them at least a guide for what the Christian godly life should be like. That was their goal, to go back to the way things were. And they were very concerned always about discipleship, how to be a disciple of Christ, that all of life should be governed by love, according to biblical standards. In this regard, in several regards, they go steps further than Luther and Calvin. But Luther and Calvin, who rejected monasticism, which we talked about last time, then went on to talk about the life of the non-monastic in certain ways, the doctrine of vocation and the priesthood of all believers and so forth. But the Anabaptist notion is that rather than a few people going off and living in a monastery, everyone should live life as if a monastic life. Okay. Some specific events and groups. As I indicated about the earliest re-baptisms, they took place in Zurich. This is where Zwingli was. He's the third of the major magisterial reformers who died earlier than the others and is less well known. There were in his circle some young men who started out being very attracted to his views, but who came to regard him as too cautious. I know, I think this is the sort of thing that happens in every reform movement, that there will be a leader who gathers some followers, and among those followers will be some who regard the original leader as going too slow. Right? I feel this way at Holden sometimes, that some of the things that we felt like we were on the forefront with, inclusive language, recycling, eating low on the food chain. Well, now we've sort of come to a moderate position, and people who are more radical come here and say, well, I thought this was a place that cared about inclusive language. Well, I thought this was a place that was careful about their resources. What are they doing using Post-its? Well, I thought this was a place that ate low on the food chain. What are you doing serving chicken on Sunday, right? Right? So some of these younger people, Conrad Grable in particular, started to move away from Zwingli, to be unsatisfied with the pace. Then they came in contact with other radical reformers and corresponded with them. It's from that correspondence we know something about what they believed. And then it came to the point of a public debate between Zwingli and some of these...
What's the name?
Zwingli.
Zwingli,
it's like this. Ulrich Zwingli, yeah, Ulrich Zwingli. A public debate about infant baptism was the formal point of disassociation between these more radical people and Zwingli. And that was the time at which then some of these people had rebaptism and were sent into exile. And this was the beginning of a, quote, free church. That means in contrast to a state church.
When did this happen?
The 1520s. Okay. The Anabaptist views spread from Switzerland. One of their major groups is known as the Swiss Brethren. They also spread and become very vigorous in the Netherlands. And as this happens, there are two outcomes that you want to note. One is they gain people and some very fine leadership. The other is the downside, namely that the Anabaptists are opposed both by the Roman Catholics and by the magisterial reformers. In the accounts of martyrdom, you can kind of tell where they took place with Protestants or with Roman Catholics by the means of execution. So both of those groups at the top opposed the radicals, in particular the Anabaptists. And sort of as an aside, one of the papers I did in graduate school, the course I did on the Radical Reformation, I looked at the Martyr's Mirror. It's a big compilation of accounts of martyrdom, and particularly women in there. And one of the things that you note in that first generation, one of the consequences for women of joining the Anabaptists was that... frequently, the midwives who continued to be Roman Catholic or Protestant would report them for not having their infants baptized. So that one way to avoid that then was to give birth without midwives. It's sort of an interesting little ripple effect of this new doctrine. Because the law was then was imposed that you had to baptize your child within 8 days of its birth. One of the most dramatic incidents in early Anabaptist history happens in the city of Munster, where a group of revolutionary Anabaptists set up a theocracy based on the Old Testament. And they institute polygamy, they elect someone king, they do a bunch of things like this. The city is stormed. And one of the people who died there was the brother of a man named Menno Simons. Now you can hear in that word that we're closing in on our topic, right? You might ask why someone named Menno Simons is the leader of a group called the Mennonites. It's because there was already a group, something called Simony, and it meant selling church offices. And so I think that's why. I'm just speculating about that. Menno Simons was born 3 years after Columbus sailed, just to get you a little bit oriented in time here. Okay, so all of this is happening while the age of exploration is taking place. He was a Roman Catholic priest who moved gradually away from Roman Catholicism to an Anabaptist position. First, he began to ask questions about the Lord's Supper. He stood to consecrate the elements at the Mass, and he had one of those kind of moments when you go, oh, really? Could this really happen? This is so weird. Could these really be changing into the body and blood of Christ? It sort of worried him. And he read lots of things. He read some Luther, and something he read in Luther convinced him that maybe this wasn't so peculiar and that he probably wouldn't be damned for having questions about this. Then he heard that someone had been beheaded for being rebaptized. And he thought, is it possible that the church could be wrong about both baptism and the Lord's Supper? And then his brother was killed in this Dacobel at Munster. And that was for him the turning point in 1535. After that, he was for 25 years the primary leader of a increasingly defined group known as the Mennonites. Not that the group wasn't there before him, but he provides a sort of focus and development for it. Now, the beliefs of the Mennonites are very much as those I described as being characteristic of the Anabaptists. The church defines the community. Okay? So the community and the church overlap. So here's the boundary of the community. Here's the boundary of the church. They're the same. And it's a strong boundary. All who are in the community are believers. And the boundaries are marked by belief as well as behavior. This is in contrast to what had been the case in medieval European Christianity, where everyone was a Christian. I mean, in a sense, community and church were marked, were coincident there too, but the standards were different. Here the standards are very high. Not just anyone can join, just pay your money and take your chances, but you had to be rebaptized. You had to show by changes in the way you lived that this is what you believed. And frankly, as in the early church, you had to be prepared for the possibility that there would be violent opposition to your belief, that you could die for this. And the Mennonites took this as a sign that they were the true church. Okay? That the true church does not make alliances with the world. The true church is distinct from the world. The true church is willing to stand for what it believes and not make accommodations. Again, this is a thing that's pretty difficult for us to understand, I think, because it's outside of the way we think, particularly if it becomes a matter of life and death. The analogy that has worked for my students sometimes is to talk about whether or not you're willing to give up something else, like your livelihood, right? If in your work somebody comes to you and says, here's a bribe, or could you just fudge a little bit on this? Or would you say, no, these are my standards, these are my principles, these are the things I will not do? Okay. Another group that breaks off from the Mennonites are the Hutterites. These come from Jacob Hutter. Now, of course, when you have these kinds of high standards, a kind of perfectionism, although they're not perfectionists, but a desire for high standards, there's always this tendency to say, oh, you're not quite holy enough, and to be breaking apart, and us saying, well, we're better, we're going to withdraw and form our own group. Andrew, you look like you're ready to spring.
It just occurred to me that the Mennonites and the Amish, could you make the distinction between those?
I will.
Okay.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
We're coming to the point in the historical narrative where that happens. But first come the Hutterites. And that is a break that comes with the leadership of Jacob Hutter, who died in 1536. One of the things that's distinctive of the Hutterites, in contrast to the other Mennonites, is that they have economic community, that they are communal in their organization. They have communal property. They may be best known for their production of community playthings. Those solid wooden toys come from the Hutterites. And they have several large communities in the United States and Canada. They're rural, almost entirely rural.
Okay. There's one about 50 miles.
Really?
Saskatchewan.
Yeah, lots there. Okay, now we come to the second historical beginning. The first was the Mennonites. Now we come to the Amish. The Amish also had a leader named Jacob. Ammon. Whose dates? No, these aren't his dates. This is when the division comes, just as the turn into the 1700s. And the issue between the larger group of the Mennonites and what comes to be the Amish is the issue of shunning. It's a little bit like a major timeout that we give kids these days, right? If you can't behave, you need to go over and sit by yourself, right? You can't be with us. It's being sent to your room. And shunning had been a Mennonite practice before. It's also something akin to shunning goes on in the Benedictine rule. If one of the monks or sisters does something that's out of line, that person is excluded from certain parts of community life until it's time for them to come back. For Anabaptists, this could be very dramatic. This is exclusion from table, right? So you're living in the same house with someone and they're being shunned. You don't speak to them. You don't eat with them. They're shut off from the community. And it was precisely how that was being applied and to what degree that causes the Amish to break off from the larger group of Mennonites. There are other things that will distinguish them. The Amish began to require foot washing as one of their rituals, uniformity of dress, and that the men wear non-trimmed beards. All of these groups have a different understanding of the sacraments than the one I sort of professed, I think, in our first session. Their view is akin to Zwingli's view, although not exactly Zwingli's view. It's much more of a memorial view, right? And I just was reading a little history of a description of the Mennonites published by the Mennonites, and they characterize the Roman Catholic and mainstream Protestant view of sacraments as magical. Okay? And that their view is that these are a memorial. It's a much more commonsensical kind of way of understanding those things. Now, there are almost no Amish left. In fact, probably there aren't any Amish left in Europe. They've come to the United States, as have many Mennonites. They came from Germany, the Netherlands, Switzerland, and Russia, where some Mennonites had first immigrated to Russia. There were Mennonites as early as the Dutch colony days in New York, but the major settlements come slightly later, starting with a settlement in Germantown, Pennsylvania, in the 1680s, and then the area of southeast Pennsylvania that we think of as Amish country, Lancaster County, those people came in about the 1700 to 1750. Then in the decades before the Civil War, there's another big influx, so that these people are now scattered west from Pennsylvania, Ohio, Illinois, Indiana, I know I just got that out of geographic order, Iowa, southern Minnesota, and so forth. Okay. Now, what about these people? What can we say about them? The Amish are sometimes called the plain people. And the whole cluster is called the quiet in the land. It's an interesting way to describe a whole people, the quiet in the land. There's a sort of you think of a sort of placid lake, the peculiarity of the Amish might make us think that they are uniform, that they're all the same. This is not the case. There are many subtle variations among these groups. But they're like what I say about Southern California's seasons. You got to pay attention. They do change. But if you're expecting season changes like we have in Minnesota, you'll miss them. If you're looking for an accessible, if somewhat idiosyncratic account of the Amish, a very popular book is this one, which I did not order, Sue Bender's book, Plain and Simple, A Journey to the Amish. She really is doing what we've been talking about here, namely, she found herself extremely attracted, first of all, to Amish quilts. She's a potter. And she sort of reframed in this little book, which you could read in half an afternoon, is that she thought of herself as an artist, as an extraordinary person, always wanting to be different. That's me. It drives my husband nuts. If anyone else has it, I don't want it, you know. Yeah. He says, well, I noticed that three people have bought this. Now you probably won't want to do that, will you, Deanne? Because you can't be like anybody else. And yet she found herself so attracted to these people who are ordinary. Right. And so with some difficulty, she arranged to go and spend some time living with an Amish family. And then later with another Amish family. And so this is her, it reminds me a little bit like those people I talked about who went out to see Antony in the desert. And that's what she was doing. She saw that these plain, ordinary people had something that she wanted. And so it's an idiosyncratic account, to say the least. But it's an interesting one. And it's not fact, here's what the Amish are like, boop, 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 boop. But here's what the Amish mean to me.
And those two families were different.
Yes, that's the point. Thank you. They were very different. One of the things she points out is that she went to the first family. She was from Berkeley, I think, right? So there's this potter from Berkeley, and she goes to live with the Amish, and the first morning at breakfast, they put out sugared cereal, and they heap spoonfuls of sugar on it. And she's like, ugh. So she just thought, I can't eat this food. And then the other family was much more whole earth kind of food. So that was one of the differences that she saw right away. Her book is called Plain and Simple, and that's a good way to characterize the Amish life. It's harder to describe than the Benedictine life because we don't have a nice rule. I can't read you passages because that's not what Jacob Ammon was about. What Jacob Ammon and his followers are about is living like the early church. It's a rural life. It's lived by a human scale and natural rhythms. And in that sense, I think it has something in common with the Benedictines, where the hours of the day are like this, and you go to bed, right? And maybe you wouldn't like to wake up at 2 in the morning, but if you went to bed at sundown, 2 in the morning wouldn't seem nearly so late as if you wait until the news and cheers are over, right? And it's a human scale. The church district is 75 families, right? Or maybe 50 families. How many people can you get in a barn or a house for worship? If it gets crowded, then you need to divide. Some anthropologists say that 50 people is the ideal number for human community. You can know 50 people. And it's interesting. If I'd made you go on with your list, about the people who are important for you knowing who you are, I bet you would have come out maybe 45, maybe 58. But I think you'd be right in that range. 50 people is about what we can know. They have private property, unlike the Hutterites, unlike the Benedictines. But they have a corporate life, and probably one of the most noted thing, well-known things about the Amish, of course, is their barn raisings. They don't have insurance. They don't buy any kind of insurance. So if your barn burns down, you build a new one, and you don't worry about it. People come and do it. And you don't worry about paying back in this generation. Right? Because the community goes on. It's not like the house, collective apartments that some of us have lived in, where you write everything down on the refrigerator door. Someone gets up in the morning and says, "Who drank the last of my milk?" Right? It's not about being even this week. It's about the long haul. Quilting parties are another example of this corporate life. There's joint ownership of church benches. The church benches. Because most Amish don't have a separate building for worship. You worship in a house or a barn. Not only does that mean that you own enough benches for everyone to sit on and you move them, it means that many buildings are designed with interior walls that can be pulled out of the way to accommodate all those benches with all those people, right? So it can get around what you'd think of as a problem. Education is something that's interesting and distinctive about the Amish. It goes usually to the eighth grade. Another famous image many of us have of the Amish is that news photo of the Amish children running into the cornfield in Iowa. Remember that? The court case that links with, interestingly, was not brought by the Amish. Somebody else brought it on their behalf. No alliance with the government. Right? Non-resistance. But someone else did it on their behalf. And so in most places, they're allowed to let their children go only to the eighth grade, and sometimes they maintain their own schools. They're very like, I heard someone here talking about going to a one-room school. It's very like what you probably went to. Yeah, it's very like that. It's a one-room school. They don't want their kids to learn to be computer literate because they don't need computers, right? They don't want their kids to learn stuff they don't know. The standard of an education is determined by its usefulness in their life and its virtue. That's what they want their children to learn. The boundaries of the community are indicated in many ways. One of them is dress. It distinguishes them from what they call the English. On the train, part of the train ride on the way out here, there was an Amish man. As soon as I saw him on the train, I knew he was Amish, right? You would know too, right? The beard. A beard, interestingly, these days, without a mustache, this is something I learned in that museum, that at a certain point, when beards and mustaches became the fashion in the late 19th century, the Amish decided no mustaches. Because it was too tempting to grow a luxurious mustache and sort of tweak it up and be vain about it. So no mustache. Yeah, but a beard. And the degree to which it is trimmed or not trimmed is one of those subtle differences from community to community. Also, I noticed, and I hope this man didn't notice me sort of like this, he had buttons on his pants. They looked like sailor's pants, you know? And not all Amish use buttons. That's a technology issue we'll talk about later. The Amish do not wear only black clothing. This is one of the things Sue Bender found very interesting, that peeking out from under the dark clothes were magenta petticoats and bright, vibrant colors. One of the things that attracts people to those quilts is the colors.
That's where they get the specs from.
And it's the same colors. They're practical, And they're plain, but they're not dull, right? One of the other things she noted, and this I noticed when I go to visit my in-laws, was that some of the young women, young people were wearing like Nikes and Adidas running shoes. And in the place where she went, this was a life cycle thing, and there would come a point in their life they'd have to decide about whether or not they were going to stay in the Amish community, and they'd have to give up those shoes. But the Amish near Goshen, I've seen adult women wearing running shoes at the swap meet. So clearly they've come to some other idea about those. Obviously, since they call people who aren't Amish the English, there's also a language issue, right? The Benedictines have the language of the Psalms and the language of the Rule. The Amish use German as a conversational language as well as the language of worship. And there may be dialect differences between what they use every day and what they use in worship. Technology is one of the things we often think about with the Amish. People tend to think of the Amish as people who don't use modern technology. They're not modern. Really, a better way, a more accurate way to think about the Amish and technology is that they're very careful users of technology. They want to retain a human scale and a natural rhythm. So they think about the consequences. I'd say they maybe are the originators of the principle, if not the term, appropriate technology, right? And what does this mean? Well, some only use hooks and eyes. Some will use buttons. I don't know of any Amish people who use zippers. And I'm not quite sure what's the deal with a zipper, except that it jams a whole lot more often than a button. The issue is much more obvious when we look at transportation. A horse and buggy takes you at a certain speed. A car takes you much faster. Right.
Yeah, when we visited back there, though, we heard that they will take a ride in somebody else's car.
Right here. And then there's the issue of owning an automobile or having a ride in an automobile.
Yeah.
Right? Which may seem to you like a trivial issue until you're for a while without a car. And you notice that most things you can do without a car in many places, and that not owning one, well, what does not owning a car let you do? What are the things about a car that drive you nuts?
Repairs.
And usually it breaks right before you want to go somewhere, right? Mm-hmm.
Gas all
the time.
Yep.
Noise, yeah, pollution, it's expensive, right? Right, I mean, there are all those things. Also, you can only drive it when you're a certain age, right? One of the some Amish people have suggested that one of the differences is you put gasoline in and nothing comes out, and you feed a horse, and you don't have to buy fertilizer, right? They're thinking about these natural rhythms. Now, some Amish will use a gas-powered engine for certain kinds of farm work, right? So it's a negotiated decision, which where my in-laws live, you see many men riding bicycles. When they're going, partly I think it's because that's an area where, as Andy and I were talking about this, that land prices have become a problem for the next generations. And so in some places, Amish have started working out, not to get strong, to get money. And in that area, there's a lot of furniture production and also, interestingly, RV conversions. So that you get van customizations and stuff that the Amish men work in, and I think they ride their bikes to work because then you don't have to take the horse and leave it there all day.
They also build the aluminum refrigerator.
No, sorry, different group, different group, whole different group. Yeah, that comes more out of the spiritualist group. Yeah, yeah.
I was told that the Amish are facing a real problem in that the none of the machine, the farm machine manufacturers are manufacturing farm machinery equipment that is not power driven.
No, I suppose that would be a problem.
When they have a failure in their
parts,
they really have a problem.
Yeah.
They can fix it fine, but I mean, it's...
Yeah, I can imagine that would be a problem.
Where they can't replace it.
Yep, I can imagine that would be the problem. The other example of technology I wanted to talk about is the telephone. And again, I thought eavesdropping is a wonderful technique for pedagogy. I heard somebody talking, you... I'm sorry, I forgot your name. You don't have your name tag in the pink shirt with buttons.
Oh.
About living somewhere where there was a phone not in your house. No, it's kind of like being at Halton, right? There's no phone. And there are a few situations for which it's really annoying, right? My grandfather died. I knew he was going to die. I should have had a plan. I didn't have a plan. I rushed down with Thomas, who was then about... 14 weeks old, and our stuff, get on the fast boat, run to Fields Point, call up my mother, talk to her for 5 minutes, decide I'm not going to Rugby, North Dakota, and then I spent the night in Chelan before I came back, you know? It was kind of inconvenient. But the social cost, what if you had a phone here? How would your experience be different? You'd be thinking, oh, I have to call about this, I have to call about that, I need to find out about the other thing. Some Amish have a phone in a little house in the middle of the field, and everyone can go out and use it when you need it, but you're not going to, you don't need a teenager's line. There's a simple way to put it. The other example, a comparison for this, might be the kibbutz. One of the women who's on the Holden board, who's a friend of mine, has spent considerable time on a kibbutz in Israel, and she said one of the things that she has found, two things she's found very difficult at her return visits to the kibbutz since she started going in the early 80s, is that the kibbutz that she is associated with, they've gotten phones and televisions in their room, in their quarters. And what that means is... people don't come to the same place anymore. And if you don't come to the same place, you don't see each other and you don't talk. Right? And so if you don't have a phone, you have to go over and visit somebody. So the decision not to have a phone, or the decision not to have that kind of technology, or the decision not to have insurance, all of those are made in part in order to preserve the community. Worship. As I said, they're divided into church districts, about 75 families who meet for worship, usually about every other week. It's conducted in High German. They make use of old hymnals, so they use the hymnals that have hymns about those martyrs, a sense of community across time. The leadership is selected by lot. And interesting, but not only by lot. I'm just so fascinated by this way of selecting a leader. They start out, they know they need a new preacher, and everybody comes by, and then they tell this person, this is who I think it should be. It's like an ecclesiastical ballot, right? And then they see who those are, who, you know, you could get maybe it's five voice nominations or something, and then they cast a lot among those people. And it's hard work, and you have to keep doing your other work. But that's where the religious leadership comes from. Contacts with the outside world. First of all, we should say everybody has to decide to join. Even if you're born into the Amish family, there's a certain stage in the life cycle, late teens, early 20s, when you decide. And many who leave will become Mennonites, right? So that they stay within the cluster, but move in a different, to a slightly less rigorous life. There are very few converts. they have commercial contacts, and that's where, you know, how we're most, they're most known. I have here a couple of, you know, postcards of Amish quilts. I could pass this around if you're not familiar with them. They sell toys, they sell produce, they sell baked goods. This is a point of contact. And then another point of contact is medical, because it's such a well-defined community. The genetic pool is small. And so certain kinds of medical research find this a very good place to do research. And the Lutheran magazine had a piece not long ago about a woman who has had a long relationship with the Amish. And it started because she was doing research about tissue retention. And that was a good place to do it. Okay, my last thing. I know Jim was looking at us. It's 5 minutes. This is a wonderful children's story. It's written up here, Patricia Polacco. It's called Just Plain Fancy. If you don't know her books and you need to buy books for small children, these are super. And I'll try and do it like they do at school. Just Plain Fancy. Caleb and his two daughters hurried along Lancaster County Road in their buggy. Cars whizzed by them, but they paid no mind. Clop, clop, clop went the horse's hoof on the pavement. Papa, Naomi asked, why can't we have a car like the English? It's not our way, child. We are in no hurry, he said as he drew up the reins and slowly directed the horse to their farmyard. Now, what you can't see is that they're behind a hatchery truck that says exotic and domestic birds. While their father unharnessed and watered the horse, Naomi and Ruth skipped toward the henhouse. The chicken were Naomi's responsibilities. She saw to their feeding and watering, as well as the collecting of their eggs. Everything around here is so plain, Naomi complained. Our clothes are plain, our houses are plain, even our chickens are plain. It would pleasure me just once to have something fancy. Pshaw, Noni, you oughtn't be saying such things, little Ruth scolded. As Naomi and Ruth searched the field for eggs laid outside the henhouse, they spotted a very unusual one nestled in the tall grass down the drive and behind the henhouse next to the road. This egg looks different from any other I ever see, Naomi said quietly. It's still warm. Let's put it in Henny's nest. This one needs to be hatched. She gently picked up the egg and eased it into her basket. Though it was a little bigger than Henny's other eggs and a little darker, Naomi gently tucked the egg into the nest while Henny and Ruth looked on. You're so good with chickens, Ruth chirped. I just know you're going to get your white cap this year. Mama says you're ready. Naomi was proud of her chickens, the way she raised them. The elders were coming for a working bee or a frolic in the coming summer, and Naomi wondered whether her parents might present her with the white cap on that day. Her thoughts were interrupted by Ruth's voice. Ain't we pleasured, she said. You wanted something fancy, and now you got it. As the days passed, Naomi and Ruth checked Henny's nest constantly. Every day they peered over the edge of the crib, watching for signs of cracks in the shells. Then one day the eggs hatched. Look at the little chick from the fancy egg, Noni, Ruth squealed. The egg was fancy inside and out, wasn't it, said Naomi. Fancy, that's what we'll call this chick. Fancy, 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 Ruth sang out as she jumped around. Naomi smiled and clapped her hands. All that afternoon, the Gales stayed with Henny, watching and studying their special little chick. Weeks passed. Henny's chicks grew quickly and were soon scratching around in the dust. They'd all lost their yellow down feathers and grown bright white ones, all of them except Fancy. Fancy looked different. There was no doubt about it. That chick wasn't plain. One afternoon in the wash house, Naomi and Ruth overheard Aunt Sari talking to Cousin Hannah about a person in the neighboring Amish community. She dressed too fancy, Sari said. She had to be shunned. Is it wrong to be fancy? Naomi asked. Yes, indeed, snapped Hannah. We are plain folk. It's our laws that we must be plain. What does shun mean? Ruth asked haltingly. Someone is shunned who's shamed in front of the elders. After that, friends and neighbors are instructed not to speak to them. I'm going to skip a little bit because Jim has been making faces at me. As soon as they were finished, they ran into the hen house. Well, what are we going to do? Oh, I got to skip. I can't skip a page, however. Fancy, what are we going to do? Fancy's too fancy to be Amish. And then Fancy ruffled up his feathers in something that took their breath away. We have to hide him. And so they went to put him in another part of the hen house, and then everybody comes, and they're having, everyone else is having a great day, except the girls are worried about Fancy. And then Fancy runs out of the barn, we're almost done, leaps up on top of the quilts. And of course, these girls are just terrified what's going to happen. Dry your tears. It was Martha who finally spoke. This isn't your doing. It's God's handiwork. Only he could think up covers like that. You mean we aren't going to shun him, Ruth asked. One can only be shunned for going against the ways of our people, Martha continued. That's no plain old chicken. This must be one of God's most beautiful creations. He's Fancy Child, and that's the way of it. And then she got her white cap, which means that she's been faithful and done what she was supposed to do. So.
Can you read that to your little boy?
Yeah. Oh, it's his book. Oh. So, thank you.